Harry, a DSTS, a Delaware Statutory Trust. I'm not familiar with it, so.
Well, since I think 2014, there's been one in 2016, couple of rules. It's a trust that's formed in Delaware for the purpose of holding businesses and or real property, and can be used very well in a 1031 exchange. And it allows someone who has the smaller property, had $100,000, $200,000 individual property, exchange it into the Delaware Statutory Trust, and then they can get professional management on a piece of a larger program, and differing from a tenant in common with less risk and more asset protection. So it's a pretty viable opportunity today.
Okay, I didn't understand all of what you just said. So
okay.
Am I exchanging my real estate into it, or just strictly changing title? No, I'm exchanging it and investing in a group investment. Is that what it is?
Yeah, you do an exchange, you go to Bill, and
okay. You
know, you turn around, you sell a property, and then you just, instead of buying another property, you make an investment in the DST for the game and for the exchange, and it works. It's like buying into a real estate mutual fund, and it works really well.
Okay, and who's in charge of that? I mean,
the promoter of the Delaware Statutory Trust. So you have, you know, the Bruce Norris, you know, Delaware Statutory Trust has these two shopping centers, and when you sell your apartment building, you can exchange into that. Now they'll own a piece of that Delaware Statutory Trust. The good part about it is that there's asset protection. So if I sue you, I won't be able to get into the Delaware Statutory Trust to reach your ownership there. So that gives us asset protection on the other side. And if I have a liability inside the Delaware Statutory Trust differing from a tenant in common, you don't have personal liability.
Okay.
So that kind of, because on a tick, you know, you'd have joint and several liability for the full amount. Here you don't have it. So with the recent rulings over the last couple of years, the DST has been actually quite effective and used a lot.
So what does it take to create a DST?
It's a lot of money, and a lot of money in acquisitions. It's not that easy. It's a big deal to create a DST. It's usually done by large promoters.
Okay. Like how much is it?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know? Okay.
I don't know the specific amounts, but
okay.
I think it's in the millions.
Okay. Yeah, usually the DSTs we've seen, they're usually $10 million and up, and so most commonly $10 to $50 million. I think the largest we've seen is about $100 million, and the minimum investment is usually $100,000.
Right, but that, not the cost to create it, but the size of the group.
The size of the overall transaction,
okay.
Yeah.
And honestly, what are they usually invested in? Things that cash flow and like large real estate,
yeah.
That type of thing? Okay.
Shopping centers, things
like
that.
Okay. No, I really didn't know. So that's why I need to know.
Yeah, where we've seen our clients use it is, you know, they're hands-on. They've got a, you know, rental portfolio, but they're kind of looking to be less hands-on. So they sell out, you know, exchange out of their properties, get into the DST where someone else is managing it, and they're kind of collecting their cash flow. Another way we've seen it is where someone's doing a 1031 exchange and they've got 50 or 100 grand left over. They're not going to find a property they like for $100,000, but if they put their 100 grand into a DST, they can satisfy the requirements of the exchange and still defer their gain and things like that. So it gives you some little more flexibility, I think.
Is the DST allowed to use leverage?
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, one of the benefits with the DST is the sponsor will set up the DST, take down the property. They have acquired it. They own it. They put the financing in place. So the investors that at 1031 exchange into the DST do not have to go through the underwriting process. So if you're an investor who maybe is self-employed or retired and doesn't have earned income, can't qualify for traditional financing, with the DST, you're just assuming like 1% of the debt or whatever percent you buy, but you don't actually have to qualify for the debt. So for those who can't qualify for financing, it can be a great way to satisfy the 1031 requirements.
Okay. Interesting.
Can you 1031 out of it eventually?
Yes. So the purchase of the DST is considered a purchase of real estate, and the sale, when the sponsor notifies all the parties that the property is going full cycle and being sold, it's also a sale of real estate. You can 1031 exchange out of it as well.
This is not a world that I know, so I don't know what I'm about to ask. So what's the difference between that and a TIC, a TIC? Is that just another investment vehicle that's?
No, a TIC, you know, I'll defer to my colleagues on this, but a TIC is not an investment vehicle. A TIC is a way in which individual fractional interest in real estate is held as tenants in common.
Oh, I'm
so
sorry. I know what
you got it. You got it. That's
yeah.
That's a tip.
I didn't know that's what it meant.
Tenants in common. So you have all the liability, joint several liability, and many of them failed.
I'm okay.
Yeah. Or it's a blood-sucking insect. It just kind of depends.
Yeah.
How you look at that.
I thought we'd invented a new structure, and I thought, I don't know what a tick is. I'm going to learn.
10 in the comments.
So now I'm on tape and being totally embarrassed. That's all right. All right. You know, Aaron, I think maybe we can open it for questions.
I think Mr. Barth, is it? Yeah. You suggested that we form an LLC and elect to be taxed as a partnership.
Yes.
And I'd had somebody just recently say the same thing, only they said not as a partnership, as an S-Corp. Can you tell me why S-Corp would be a bad option?
Well, yeah. First of all, it depends on what the heck you're doing, okay? So if you are running a business, all right, you might want to form a LLC and tax it as an S-Corporation for all the reasons. No gross sales tax involved, salaries. It's S-Corporation for tax purposes. But as my accounting colleagues will tell you, if you're acquiring real property, you do not want to tax it as an S-Corporation. You lose a tremendous amount of tax benefit associated with that. Why don't you deal with that? Let me give it to you.
Yeah, so as a general rule, we definitely don't like to have appreciating assets inside a corporation for tax purposes, whether it's a C or an S-Corp. There's different reasons for that, but it can create complications from a tax perspective. Let's say your S-Corp owns real estate that has a loan, and you need to refinance it, but the lender says, hey, I'm only going to lend to you personally. So what technically happens is that the corporation then has to distribute the asset to you on paper as a title transfer. And what happens from a tax perspective is that's phantom income to you. And so all that appreciation that happened now can become taxable just because you want to refi. So that's one reason why. But as a general rule, yeah, we definitely try to shy away from having appreciating assets inside an S-Corp or a C-Corp.
Yeah, from a C-Corp perspective, one thing we touched on earlier, a reason not to hold appreciating asset like rental real estate is that it does not ever get long-term capital gains treatment just because that's not available to C-Corporations. The other thing is, you know, when we own rental real estate, one of the good things about that is we get to take depreciation write-offs, and we want to create a loss to offset our personal taxable income. And because a C-Corporation is its own tax-paying entity, that means that loss is trapped at the C-Corp level. It does not ever reduce our personal income taxes.
Another, I think, very important point is that if you have a corporation, taxation of the LLC, and you have appreciated real property inside that entity, if you take it out for any reason, it's a taxable event. While if it's taxed as a partnership, you can remove the appreciated property and maybe put it into another entity, and it's not a taxable event. That's a big one.
A difference between TICs and DSTs here. Comment. The preferred way of doing this with all the syndicators is now DST. So TIC is kind of the older, not preferred way, and DST is the new way. One of the differentiations is, as I understand, I wanted to confirm, DSTs basically as an investor, I have no control and I have no obligations and I don't have any voting rights whatsoever. As a TIC, I had some obligations, and as I understand, there had to be unanimous consent of all the TIC owners to do big things like sell the whole property. And therefore, one TIC investor could hold out and destroy all the actions of the whole TIC property. So, little question, as a DST investor, is this definitely a passive investment? And I should be listing it as on my Schedule E as a passive, whereas on my TIC investments, because I actually did work for the property, I went out and inspected the property and I did accounting for the property, I always considered it as an active investment. Comment?
In terms of the first part of the question, you know, how they're structured and who has control, I think that's a fairly accurate statement from what I understand. You know, from a tax perspective, you own a piece of a property that's owned by the DST, they're going to give you the way we've seen most of them, they're going to give you like, you know, if you guys invest in a partnership, you get a K-1 at the end of the year that shows your share of the income or expenses. It's kind of similar. They're going to give you kind of an informational letter, K-1, that's going to say, here's your share of the income and expense. But you're still reporting on your personal return showing a rental property. It's just you're showing, you know, only 10% or 5% or whatever of those numbers that they give you. Now, whether, you know, going to your other part of the question, whether it's passive or active, generally that's still going to be on a Schedule E. It's just whether how you treat the loss differently or not for tax purposes, essentially.
But can I report it as active if I do something as a TIC owner?
In order to do it as active, you would need to own more than 10% of it. So most of my scene are, you know, people are owning less than 1% or 2% or something like that. But
okay, Karin, we covered this a little bit last year, but I heard a new term, a bail-in. There was a conversation about the federal government starting to force the Roth bucket for traditional IRAs. Has that stopped?
You know, that was being considered when the tax laws were being examined earlier, and they were calling it Rothification. But luckily, all of our Rothification fears went away, and they decided, and they deemed not to to do that at this time. So it looks like Trump is going to stick to that.
The new tax bills, sunsets, so things like estate taxes, whatnot, so we're redoing all of our estate taxes, but a lot of those sunset in just a few years, and so they could change it and go down, and this current tax law isn't necessarily grandfathered in just because we paid a lot of money for tax preparation, is that correct?
Yeah, under the new bill, a lot of, you know, there's so much to it, but a lot of it's going to sunset after 2024, 25, whatever the year is. But with anything, obviously, keep in mind that if there's a new president, a new Congress in 2, 3, 4 years, they could totally get rid of it altogether. So it kind of depends on how you look at it, I guess, you know.
Yeah, I think Harry does the estate planning side of it, and I know we've seen, you know, estate taxes go up and down back in 2010 when it was, you know, years when it was exempt, and then it keeps going up. So, yeah, that's a hard thing that, you know, it's a question we get from clients a lot, too. It's like, well, how much estate planning should I be doing, knowing that it's going to sunset or it's going to change? But so I don't know if, you know, you have something to comment on that.
Yeah, the estate tax was put together in, I think, 1800-something to finance the Spanish-American War. And still with us, and it's been repealed and changed 19 times. So, and it's been used as a political weapon against those that have assets. So it appears, again, not to be political, when we move to the left, you'll see a higher incidence of estate taxes. They want to beat up people with assets. We move to the right, we'll see an attempt to repeal or a large amount of estate tax exemption. So the question is that there's a window of opportunity that opened up in January where the estate tax and the gift tax is unified. So they're the same. So we can give away up to $22 million. And with proper planning, you can almost leverage that to $220 million. Today, to get it to the next generation, so all the future appreciation will be in the next generation's estate. And even though the estate tax law may sunset, as you said earlier, by a change in president, a change in Congress, or by inaction at the end of 2025, what we've done in this window of opportunity that we have will be grandfathered in. So we have an opportunity, and I would strongly suggest that we take advantage of that opportunity to move assets to the next generation.
I've got a question. Just rumor floating around. So the probability of taxing wealth, existing wealth, so wealth tax, an annual wealth tax, you haven't heard about that? And how would it get voted on? I'm just curious. How do you change something like that?
Let me answer that one. It's not constitutional for that to happen by the part of the federal government. So they can't do it.
Okay.
States could do it. States have the power to do that. The federal government does not. That's why there's no property tax, federal property tax.
Right.
That's why we have a state property tax. Federal government, they could tax income. They can't tax assets.
But that could be a state decision.
Could be.
How do they vote? How would they get that passed, if you will?
Well, think about it this way. How do I put this nicely?
You don't have to put it nicely.
No.
We'll edit it.
Just look at California and look at the electorate. Okay.
Right.
You have 7 or 8% of the electorate that has a significant amount of wealth, and 93% of the electorate that doesn't have any wealth. And they turn around and say that we want to, they did it with the millionaire's tax, they did it with the increase to 13%. They had to put it on a ballot and say, hey, look, we put it on the ballot, we can have better education for schools, we can have better hospitals, we have more money for the nurses, more money for the firefighters, and all that stuff. We got to put it on the ballot. You know, it would have been Jerry Brown, now it could be Gavin Newsom, puts it on, they get it on the ballot, and then you have the 97% voting against the 10%.
It needs is to be publicly passed by 51%?
Yeah, it's a done deal.
Okay.
It's a done deal. Now, whether or not
it's a constitutional challenge under the federal constitution, a different question, but that's how it happens. It won't happen, it depends on the demographics, and California could easily pass.
Have you heard what I'm mentioning?
I've heard about two things. I heard about, one, that California may be considering a death tax, okay, which is a tax on wealth.
Right.
Just at the end, you know, as it goes between generations. And then also heard that California may be considering in their death tax, picking up everything that the federal government does not. So if the federal government repealed the estate tax, California would impose an estate tax equivalent to what the federal tax would have been.
Wow.
So
yeah. If you move out of California and you die in Florida, they're gonna have you file a form that happened. Well,
interesting. People that have moved out of the United States in order to avoid tax get hit with an expatriation tax of 35%. However, as we know, that California attempted to tax the retirement benefits. So if you lived in California all your life, accumulated your IRA, your 401k, and your pension, and then moved to Texas, okay, and then started taking your benefits, so you got the deductions while you were in California. California made a claim that we now want to tax the benefits when they come out in Texas, kind of that clawback rule that you were talking about, and the Supreme Court said you can't do that.
Okay.
It's a violation of the Constitution.
Cool.
So, but they were doing it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Greedy, I told you.
Is there a way for my IRA to join with my son's IRA to buy some asset?
So what you want, so your IRA and your son's IRA, you want, you, yes, you can do that. You can do that, and it's an exception as long as you record or you own the asset concurrently. So that is the exception, where you and your son are disallowed to each other, as long as neither one of you had any ownership interest in the asset before the acquisition, and you joined into this new asset, and you concurrently, then it's okay.
Does it have to be a split 50? I'm over here, sorry.
It can be, hi.
It can be any percentage of the investment?
It can be any percentage, right, and but you can, neither you nor your son can ever have a use of the asset, say it's a house, a property. Neither your ascendants or descendants can ever live in the property. You can never sell your interest to your son. Your son can never sell his interest to you.
Ran into a client March of this year. They're at the airport. We're like, where are you going? They're like, we're going on like our third cruise this year. We've sold everything in California, put everything in storage. It's cheaper to live on a cruise ship than it is to live in the state.
What are cruise ship taxes, Harry?
Well, technically you're in international waters, and you don't necessarily have to claim a residence. How would you be taxed?
Uh-huh.
You're welcome.
I don't know the answer to that, but I mean, we go on a lot of cruises, and I do see there's a larger and larger population living on the ship. My understanding is on the cruise, it's duty-free, right? So you buy, you know, gifts, alcohol, cigarettes, no tax. I imagine that's what it would mean for income tax purposes, but I don't actually know the answer to that.
I worked on a cruise ship that was based in the Mediterranean for 6 months in my 20s. I was taxed at the federal level, but at the state I was not. So, I don't know. It was just interesting to see if they were getting news. There's actually hacker courses on how to retire, and I guess this was one of the strategies, and I was just curious if you had heard.
We don't, as far as I know, we don't have any clients living on cruise ships, so I don't know. Hasn't come up yet.
My question deals with LLCs. Is there one LLC that would be acceptable in many states in relation to, or do you have to have separate LLCs for each and every state? How would that work?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
In other words, if you opened up an LLC with your LLC, we'll say if you had an LLC in Arizona, would you be able to use that LLC to buy property in Wyoming or Utah or Salt Lake City?
Sure.
That kind of thing?
Absolutely, but you will qualify that LLC to do business in each of those states. So it's an Arizona LLC authorized to do business in Utah, acquiring properties in Utah. Absolutely.
Thank you.
If you roll over IRAs or 401ks into insurance annuities, would that be protected?
Okay, so, all right, but I want to understand the question. So if you're moving, you have now money in a 401k, and you have money in an IRA, and you're rolling those monies out of the 401k and out of an IRA into an annuity that's not in an IRA or a 401k, then the whole thing is taxable. because it's not you've changed the ownership from the IRA and the 401k to an annuity that's non-qualified. It's a completely taxable. You pay full tax and 10% if you're under 59.
What about asset protection?
Well, asset protection. Okay, so if it's a 401k that's ERISA qualified, it's completely exempt from the claims of creditors. If you move to an annuity, all right, or an insurance contract, it depends on where you're living. In some states, insurance contracts are, the cash values of insurance contracts are exempt from the claims. First, you got screwed when you took it out of the IRA and you paid all the tax, so you lost half of it anyway. Now you have it in an insurance, you have it in an insurance policy. If you're in the state of California, the insurance policy, only $9,700 of cash value is exempt from the claims of creditors. Everything above that is subject to the claims of creditors. In 39 states, cash values of life insurance contracts are not subject to the claims of creditors. In some states like Nevada, an annuity is an exempt asset from the claims of creditors. In California, annuity is subject to the claims of creditors. So in California, that move would be terrible because you'd wind up being taxed on the whole thing, and the whole thing would pretty much still be subject to the claims of creditors. So there's better ways to do it. But now the second question is would you have, if you had a bunch of money in a 401k or an IRA and you transferred it to an annuity type contract within the IRA, you can do that. That's not a taxable event. But in California, it doesn't change it because it's an IRA asset. But in some states that have annuities that are exempt, you'd wind up getting a double asset protection, one from the IRA and second by the contract and the way in which it's held. That makes sense.
Question. So if I use a self-directed IRA to purchase a residential property and then I want to put it on Airbnb, I'm not allowed to make personal improvements to the property like doing maintenance on it myself, right? Mm-hmm. I have to hire people to keep from being taxed, I guess, right, to make it a taxable mm-hmm. property. So if I do Airbnb and make a short-term rental, I mean, normally if I was a long-term rental, I would have to hire a property manager to collect rent and make improvements on properties. If I do Airbnb, can I manage the Airbnb myself, manage the guest check-ins, manage?
I'll explain what you can do, okay? So what you can do is you can screen the people that are there. You can pick up and collect their payment. But it can't be, like, they can't pay you personally on PayPal. It's not like that, but if they write a check made payable to your IRA, you can pick up that check and collect it, all right, if your IRA owns the property. And you can hire third-party vendors to do the work, like the maids and the pool cleaning guy, what have you.
Right, so I could hire the maids, right?
Yes, you can hire them.
And if the guests would pay Airbnb, the Airbnb would have to pay me into the IRA instead of me, right?
All the proceeds would have to go into the IRA, and all the expenses would have to be paid for by the IRA, exactly. Okay. And if you had, say, for example, you've got these Airbnb properties and you want to buy some new refrigerators, like you've got four of them, and so you go to Lowe's or Home Depot, whatever, and you get a receipt for them, you know, like an invoice, you present that to your IRA custodian, and then along with a direction letter, and then those funds are, a check is cut then to, say, Lowe's or Home Depot, and you take that to them, and then you go buy the refrigerator, and they deliver it.
Well, may I market that property? Is that part of?
Well, you want to be careful of what's called offering services to the plan. That's a prohibited transaction. So once you start, getting active like that, you can hire a marketing company, you can hire somebody like a virtual assistant to do it. Okay. But I would steer clear of, getting in that gray area and offering services to the plan.
Does that hold for LLCs too?
She asks if it holds for LLCs. Everything that's true for an IRA is true for an IRA-owned LLC. The special purpose LLC that the IRA can own. The IRA-owned LLC is just a pass-through entity. It is IRA money, and all those IRA rules do apply. So,
Harry, for charitable remainder trusts, if you're sued for some, like an accident like you were talking about before, they wouldn't have access to anything in the charitable remainder trust?
No. So charitable remainder trust is a trust asset, not your asset, but what they would have access to is the charitable remainder trust usually has a requirement for a distribution of income. So the distribution of income, which when it gets to you, would be of asset that's available to the creditor.
Question.
Could you talk about the advantages of having a series LLC as compared to traditional LLCs?
Okay, so let's deal with that one. So again, where A little state specific here. So California does not have series LLCs. So start there. But we will recognize a series LLC that's established in another state. But it's problematic in this respect. California says, so if, let's say the purpose of a series LLC is to sometimes save costs. So in other words, we create the master LLC, and then we have cell 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And you can have separate properties in cell 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And in the states that recognize series LLCs, you're only paying one LLC fee for the master, and you're not paying for the cells. That's an accounting nightmare, but that's for the accountants to deal with. But, oh, it is. It's an accounting nightmare. But the troubles in California, who will recognize, let's say you set up one in Nevada with cell 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, California Franchise Tax Board, remember I told you they are greedy, they turn around and say each cell counts as an individual LLC, so it's 800, 800, 800, 800, 800, and 800. If that's the case, you might as well have separate LLCs with a holding company, which is acceptable versus something which is not acceptable in California and costs just as much. So, basically, poo-poo.
This question's for Harry. With your $50 million, lawsuits,
I thought you were going to kick him out.
We're all going to lose everything. Got a question. Your personal home and your second homes, if you own a lot of real estate, what would you suggest to hold those entities to protect yourself as much as you can?
Okay, so whoever gave the question, give it to me again.
Sorry. Your personal home and second homes, in our case, they're significantly valuable.
Okay, personal
valuable,
home and second home, right.
And to protect them against any outside undue influence.
Got it. First and second home protected. So, complicated, but let me make it as simple as I can. The best form of protection in general is counterintuitive to everything that we've been taught by our parents, and that's not to have a lot of equity in the property. Because the equity in the property is all that the property is worth. So if I got a, you know, you had a scenario even during 08 and 09, people have a $2 million house, a $3 million house, but the property dropped in value and they have, you know, $2.9 million mortgage on a $3 million house is worth nothing. No one wants it. It's safe. Now the trouble is you got a bunch of equity that you've built off because, you know, you got to pay off the house, you got to pay it down. That's still depression age psychology, and the exemptions in California really are not conducive for that. We don't have unlimited homestead exemptions. In California, we have a significant amount of equity. So just dropping a home into an LLC is not going to work. A court's not going to buy it. So you got a couple of things, three things that you can do. Well beyond today, but let me give you what they are. That's why there's green sheets on the tables. Please get them in. So one is to have the house put into a second residence put into a qualified personal residence trust, which is an estate planning tool and technique that can provide significant asset protection for our home. Just super duper. Second one is to sell the home to an intentionally defective grantor trust, which inherently allows the home to be owned by a trust, and you own a note on the property, which will also give asset protection. And third, other than the equity, is what we call the residential shield trust, which is a land trust, which is an Illinois land trust adopted for California, and then the beneficial interest, the right to live there, you know, stay there, sell it, do everything that's to the beneficiary. Those are all assigned to a limited liability company, and that throws a great monkey wrench in. It's relatively inexpensive to do and a great way to help protect first and second residences. But if the second residence, however, is used by workers, co-workers, family members, employees, you rent it out sometime, Airbnb, right into an LLC.
Thank you.
I just had a question on if you have out-of-state LLCs and California's coming in 800 here, 800 there, 800 there, are they also getting the fees if you have gross revenue over a minimum?
No. So what happens there is the California gross sales tax is dependent upon California-based income, and then my accounting pals will have to do an allocation to make that work. But the gross sales tax doesn't apply. But we don't see that too often because the gross sales tax is $250,000 and up. you know, where it starts to kick in. And if we do an analysis and find out that the rental income is going to be, you know, $1 million worth of rental income, which would trigger a significant amount of gross sales tax, should it even been in California, we would change the structure from an LLC to a limited partnership with an LLC general partner and eliminate primarily all the gross sales tax. So there's ways around it depending upon the situation.
Installment sale question. If you sell an installment sale, the money received is taxable in interest as ordinary income, principal as capital gain if you hold it enough. What about recapture of depreciation? When does it get taxed and at what rate?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you do an installment sale, even if you receive payments over time, the depreciation recapture piece actually is taxable in the year of the sale. So that's not deferred, unlike a 1031 exchange with depreciation recapture. So that's, you know, could be one downside depending on the dollar amount, obviously.
I have a two-part depreciation question. So if I buy an out-of-state property for 100 and put 40 into it, and now it's worth 200, how does depreciation work? Is it still on the 100 if I refinance it to be 200, and what happens to the 40 that I put into it? And then you mentioned bonus depreciation. If the property that I buy has like things in it already, like appliances and whatnot, how does depreciation on that work?
The first part of your question in terms of what is depreciation basis calculated, so it's based on your purchase price and any improvements you put in. The fair market value of a property is irrelevant for depreciation purposes. So in your example, your cost basis would be the 140, right? Bought it for 100, you put in 40. That's the starting point at which your depreciation is calculated. If you buy a property with existing assets in there, such as refrigerators and things like that, it just depends on, you know, whether you're able to have a reasonable breakout for what those items are. We recently had a client who purchased a property, and in that purchase agreement, for one reason or another, the seller wanted to specially allocate the price. So, you know, X amount to the property, and, you know, for all the furniture, I'm selling it separately. So that's a really good way, you know, on the buyer's end, if you can get that, then you're able to potentially accelerate the depreciation or use 100% bonus depreciation because now it is available for used assets as well.
Very cool. So just do a bill of sale concurrently with the closing of real estate?
Yeah, or like a purchase price allocation to say how much of that is agreed upon.
So how do you value that? Do you need to get like a third party to do like some sort of analysis and report or?
Well, in the example where you've got a document with the seller, you're valuing it based on your negotiation, obviously. If absent that, in a normal situation, usually you need to kind of get what we call like a cost segregation company to come in and do an analysis of the property to determine how much is related to personal property or land improvements. There's companies out there that will let you do this online. You kind of do it yourself. I know they're out there. But my understanding is the IRS doesn't put a lot of weight to that if you were to get audited. They really want, you know, the support from somebody who's an expert in the field, obviously.
Could you do like donations and just go online and try to find used similar, print them out and sort of put it in the file and justify? Because I just see what you're saying, like I could negotiate a refrigerator is worth $50,000, but it doesn't mean that it's
right,
worth
right. Yeah, obviously at the end of the day, it's got to be reasonable. You know, and if somebody did do all that work to kind of find some support for what used things cost, I'm sure that's better than not doing that. But it's probably not as good as if you had hired a company to kind of do a study. But you know, you got to look at your cost benefit, obviously.
Oh, I saw on the voting ballot in November, one of the people to vote for said, if you vote for me, I will remove the franchise tax, the $800 a year. Is that possible? And if it sounds like a good reason to vote for him, but will it actually happen? Because it sounds like California likes that money.
Okay. Start with greedy. All right. But second of all, just not to wax politically for a second, if they took the $800 and moved it to a reasonable fee like any other state, average is $150, It would, again, increase a boom of business in California. We would use more entities. It would create better asset protection. It would create better legal structures. It would make California a more sophisticated state. We're not going to do it. You know, they talk about those kinds of things, but philosophically, our state has been, we all know this. Had California just tried to be a business-friendly state, my God, it would be a phenomenal state, but it's not going to happen. The $800 is worth too much to them to do that. So that's just my two cents for whatever it's worth.
What would be the difference in structuring like an asset protection plan where you'd have a trust where the beneficiary becomes an LLC or an S corp versus having an LLC hold property and then that in turn would be under a revocable trust or a living trust?
Okay. So I think I understand the question. So let's start with the second part. If you have a living revocable trust that holds an interest in an LLC, all the asset protection is in the LLC. There is no asset protection in the living revocable trust. The living revocable trust is there for estate planning, privacy and probate avoidance purposes, and the family distribution plan. It's a very important document, but no asset protection. So it's how you design the LLC. Is it a multi-member LLC? What state is it in? What's the operating agreement look like? So that provides reasonably good asset protection, even in California. Now, you go the other way around. Your question the other way around is which? That the okay, so creating a land trust, so to speak, where the beneficiaries control and then have the beneficial interest assigned to an LLC. That works relatively well, but it's non-traditional, and that's what we use as the residential shield trust. You'd be better off the other way around with the LLC holding title to the property.
If you own property that was purchased in a, just husband and wife, essentially, and then sold as an investment through a 1031 with Exeter, and now you want to move that into one of these LLC structures, what is the process for that?
Just do it.
Just do it.
Okay. As long as you got a husband and wife that own it, and now you want to create a new LLC, it's community property. The LLC is community property as well. It's not an issue.
Bill, do you remember the email that I don't know if we've talked about it yet. I've been in and out of the room, but it was where the entity needed to change after a 1031 exchange, and I forget if it was a single member LLC or individual, and then it was going to end up after the 1031 exchange going to co-ownership. Maybe Amanda, you remember as well. I don't recall.
Vaguely. I think I needed counseling after that one.
Emotional support.
Yeah, so there was an emailed question before the event where the son bought a piece of real estate with his money as well as the dad's money, but the son was the only person on title, and the property was reported for tax purposes as if it was 100% owned by the son. Now it's several years later, they're doing a 1031 exchange, and the son and dad both want to be on title with a replacement property. So that was the question.
Go.
Go, Bill.
And did they say why?
Well, I think that it was because the dad had always, funded part of the initial purchase, so dad wants back in the deal.
I think the first issue is the individual showing intent was the son. So the son bought the property, essentially put most of the money down, was on title, reported all the tax consequences. So from a tax perspective, I think the son has really demonstrated the intent that he owns the property. So he probably needs to be the one that does a 1031 exchange, buys the replacement property. If we add the father to the equation, it could work as tenants in common. The value of the property, the percentage of the property the son acquires has to be equal to or greater than the property value that the son sold. So that's my off-the-cuff answer. There's obviously a lot of moving parts there, so we'd have to dig deeper and make sure there's not something else that might cause some issues there.
Could they, going to kind of what you were talking about earlier, could they he could, the son require the replacement property and then wait 24 months to form the LLC with the dad and then add the dad to the LLC?
Absolutely, that would work. So the son would acquire it as an individual, show intent for you know, holding it for 24 months, and then after that could create the partnership interest and contribute it.
You
could do a gift, but then you gift the cost basis, I think, to the father. So the father would effectively get the son's cost basis,
but
which may be okay.
It's still a gift, though. It would be a gift from son to father.
Question on over here, 1031 exchange. If I move my rental property to another property and do 1031 exchange, and then 2 years later, after 24 months, I decide to move in, make it my primary residence. Now my primary residence I have to do something with. I either have to sell it or rent it. If I don't want to pay the gains on that home, there's no way to transfer that through an exemption to the new property. I mean, I can't have two primary residences, right? So
are you talking about the property tax exemption or the $500,000 tax?
The $500,000.
Now the $500,000, that's the Section 121 or 121 exclusion. You could do that one every 2 years. So in that case, you could sell the original primary residence if you chose to sell it, take the $500,000 tax-free exclusion. The other property was rental property. So it was rental first, and then you moved into it and converted it to your primary residence. Mm-hmm. So once you've lived in it for 2 years, you'll qualify for the 121 exclusion, but it's going to be prorated because it was investment property first, then a primary residence. So you have to have your tax advisor look at that and prorate that gain.
I see. Okay.
I'm W-2 now, so I have an IRA. But after I retire, let's say I reestablish my lawn mowing business from when I was 15, and now I want to roll over into a solo 401k.
Yes.
Is that possible?
It is, until you're 70 and a half, in which case you would no longer be able to contribute. So,
I think most of us, I've got property in California, but I want to move it out. I don't want the property here anymore, move out of state. Is there any way that we're going to ever be able to avoid that clawback from California?
Good question. I agree with Harry that I think it's a constitutional issue. I think it's going to be challenged at some point. Just like the retirement account issue was, but until somebody steps up at the plate, gets audited, gets taxed, and then they fight it, it is what it's going to be. But I think if it was me, I would 1031 exchange out of the state into whatever state you're looking at, which is typically a tax-free state, and then just hold it and wait till somebody challenges it.
Or hold it. Can you hold it and maybe put that into a Roth or an IRA and then just keep it until, you know, you're at 70 and a half, and then California's still going to come after you?
Good question. I think California would still look at that, but if this is property you hold in your individual name, you wouldn't be able to contribute it to a Roth or a traditional IRA. It would have to be something acquired in the IRA. So if it's outside the IRA, there's no way to put it into the IRA. So
the IRA could never acquire an asset you personally own.
Okay, so but once if I did the exchange and I created the IRA or the Roth beforehand and then purchased them, would that qualify?
You mean sell your current property and then buy the new property in an IRA?
Correct, out of state.
No, it wouldn't qualify for 1031 exchange treatment because two different entities were involved. You sold as an individual, you acquired as a retirement account, which is a completely different tax.
Or if they were held
entity.
In an LLC?
No, it'd still be a totally different asset, yeah.
If all of my rental properties are out of state, is it ever a good idea to 1031 or just acquire properties in California considering all of these scenarios?
No.
Should I stay out of California with my rental properties?
Economics, but no, you know. The economics of the deal is great in California. California is problematic. It's a high tax state. It's a high liability state. So if you have properties outside that are doing well, fine. But sometimes there are greater opportunities in California, so you try to structure around them. That's why we're all here.
Yeah. If you asked that question in, say, 2008 or 9, it would be, it'd be a really good opportunity to exchange back into California and buy stuff on sale. And now, 10 years later, it's no longer on sale. It's, you know, reached a very high number again. So the answer is it depends on the time frame, probably, not just the liability, but the numbers.
This is, again, for Harry.
getting our money
because you do estate planning.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so somebody sets up a family trust.
This is free legal advice today. I love it. Just joking. Go ahead.
Suppose many of us set up family trusts. And suppose upon death, that trust is going to, you know, go on for a while before everything's distributed. Maybe it's going to go on for 10 or 15 years.
Cool off a lifetime, yeah.
Is there any way, if you set that family trust up in California, is there any way to put into your will that as soon as you pass, you want the trust to move to a state that has no sales tax?
When you say no sales tax, you mean...
income tax.
No,
one
income
of the big
tax.
Five.
Sure. So the answer to that question is absolutely yes, okay? You can. There's a provision that's put in the trust. It's a jurisdictional provision that says although the trust was created under California law, the successor trustee has the ability to change the jurisdiction and administration of the trust to any other state which is in the best interest of the beneficiaries. So if California is whacking them with 13% tax... And South Dakota has none, then the trustee would have the ability to re-domicile the trust to South Dakota and avoid the tax.
And would the trustee have to be in the new state, or could they still be the trustee in California?
Well, no. But under California law, if the trustee, it's another constitutional challenge. If the trustee is in California, then California claims tax on the entire trust.
So you'd have to have a trustee in the other state.
South Dakota. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
But maybe your family could form a trust office in South Dakota, and then the trustee would be South Dakota. Uh-huh. Form an LLC in South Dakota. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Follow up to that. So if we did a trust in South Dakota, would the trustee still have to be in South Dakota? Could they be in California?
If the trustee is in California on a South Dakota trust, California will claim tax on the entire trust.
Even if it was created in there? Okay.
It's the trustee. Okay. It's the trustee.
Okay.
Let's end here, because there's probably some questions, but it's starting to get a little personal. Let's end here. Everything's recorded. I don't think I heard anything completely inappropriate, but I'll talk with the speakers to make sure everything's kosher, and it'll take a couple weeks. I'm going to send out a survey. This is the first time we've ever done this format. Probably next year we would go back to do something a little bit more basic, because laws change as well. But if you like this, please give us your feedback so we know how to improve every year. That would be great. Video out. Is there anything else? I'll also email all the contact information for all the speakers. The green forms, I don't think you guys did the one-hour free consultation last year. This is new. So please take advantage of that. That's very generous. And who does it need to go to? Is it at your, I think of a table. So just find Harry or one of his team to give those to before you go. Or if you filled it out and leave it on the table, I'll walk around and get it. Please just network a little bit. Take your time. Valet might be a little bit backed up with us all leaving, but thank you for coming today. Amanda, there's a chart you mentioned. The UDFI information is in the pamphlet that you've got. There's three examples in there. Okay? Thank you for coming, and for those subscribers, we'll see you at lunch at Maggiano's.